for those of you who may not have been here earlier during the week, I'll just pass this around, which is a bibliography of references on the state of Washington, mostly Eastern Washington, since that's the area to which this area really belongs, that are non-technical and that may be of interest to you in terms of the geology and the archaeology and the natural history of the area. You're welcome to keep this. Those of you who are somewhat familiar with the literature of the area will see lots of omissions, and there are, particularly some of the superb books that have come out in the last few years on the North Cascades. And I've not included them simply because if I once started there, the list would almost never end. And a good many of those, as well as references to others, you'll find in the library, just down the hall and to your left, second door to your left, so that they're readily accessible. And most, if not all, of these are not in the library here, so they're things that you might look up when you get home. This week we've been talking about the endless chain of events which forms the web of life of which we're a part. And we talked a little bit about our position in the food cycle at the top of the pyramid of energy that ecologists like to talk about, which puts us not only in a very advantageous position, but also in a very vulnerable position, since with modern technology that we've developed, we are now very much capable of destroying the balance that comprises the lower portion of the pyramid on the top of which we happen to be sitting. And this puts us in the rather unenviable position of being able to destroy the foundation on which we are dependent. We talked a little bit also about the length of time that has been necessary to produce the resources on which we are dependent. The building of the landscape of Eastern Washington is an example. Hopefully with the idea of pointing out that the resources that we draw on are the results of tens and hundreds of millions of years of Earth history. And therefore, in terms of our history, there are non-renewable resources, since our span is not likely to encompass an equivalent period of time. We also pointed out that for those of us who live in this country now, however strongly we might feel about our attachment to it, it still is somewhat ironic for us to sing, as Woody Guthrie did, this is my land, this is your land, when for at least 13,000 years that we know of, and perhaps as many as 35,000 years, this was not our land. It, of course, has not been our land for more than the last few hundred years. And having preempted this land and taken from the people who once occupied it not only their land, but also their heritage and their culture, becomes evident in terms of historical perspective that we'll never really understand our own position in this endless chain unless we can appreciate our position relative to those who were here before us, and thus the concern for the first Americans, of whom we saw a little bit yesterday. This means that whether we appreciate it or not, the search for their heritage then becomes the search for our heritage. And here the distinctions then perhaps between those who occupied the country before us and those of us who are here now from other origins really breaks down. It becomes a common cause. And the origins of man in the New World is something then that is of intrigue to all of us, whether we have Indian blood in our veins or not. What I'd like to do would be to trace the development of our understanding of early man in the Pacific Northwest, particularly in eastern Washington, again, since this is where we're located, and since this happens to be where most of the recent events have taken place in our learning of his history, to try to give you a feeling for, I suppose, what it was that Edwin Land, the inventor of the Polaroid camera, had in mind when he was asked extemporaneously to speak on behalf of a group of scientists who had been invited to the White House to receive the nation's highest award for scientific achievement. And Land said, paraphrased, something like this, that in thanking the vice president who had made the presentation for the country on behalf of his fellow scientists, he hoped that he would realize that all of us are here because we are passionate men, and that the great driving passion in the life of a scientist is curiosity. That whether we as scientists had been born and grown up in a country which, as ours has done, has supported science very, very strongly through billions of dollars of money made available for education and facilities and research, or whether we had been born and raised in a country in which attempts had been made, as was true in the past, for example, in Galileo's time, to suppress the growth of knowledge, still that same driving force of curiosity would be the driving passion of our lives, and that our attempts would be no less under those conditions to follow this curiosity than they are now. I think that's a remarkable statement. I think it's a very profound statement. I think it's interesting that without having known anything about Edwin Land's comments, which have never been published, that Jack Schmidt, who was the first geologist to go to the moon and on the crew of Apollo 17, in a television interview during Apollo 16, made the comment that although there are obvious reasons for economic and military and political purposes to go to the moon, that the most important reason is not the spin-off economic benefits that we'll get, not the military advantages that could come from having certain capabilities, but simply that man needs to explore things because they're there. And this, of course, has echoes of other similar statements by other people going back through hundreds and actually thousands of years, which to me suggested there probably is really something to it. It's an innate quality that we have. Some of you saw the movie 2001, and if you recall in the movie 2001, one of the recurrent themes was the appearance of a mysterious, inexplicable black slab which suddenly appeared and which no one understood. And whether it occurred before the advent of man on Earth, whether it occurred during the time of man on Earth as we know him or at some time in the future, there was one thing that happened each time that black slab appeared, and that is when people reached out to touch it and to touch the unknown, a new world was opened to them, literally and figuratively. The black slab could represent, and who knows, which is one of the nice things about the the symbolism. Science, religion, philosophy, knowledge of any kind. Importantly, it represents the unknown. And at any one of those times, to have failed to reach out for the unknown would have been a failure to have moved the next step into the new world that was opened as a result of that search. Well, this suggests, of course, that there is a continual change in the things for which you are reaching. And in the discussions that we had earlier in the week, someone made the comment that in terms of education, what we really should be trying to study would be things that would give us the mechanics to do this. For example, reading and arithmetic. I think this is too narrow and too short. If the suggestion is made that these things should be studied to the point of exclusion of other things, which are transitory anyway, such as art styles, which are changing, musical tastes, which are changing, scientific ideas are changing. I can write on the blackboard a whole list of theories which were pretty well accepted when I was in high school or even when I was in graduate school that have now gone down the tube. This is a failure to understand, I think, what science is all about. Science is not a list of facts. Science is a way of thinking. And if the thinking is effective at all, then of course the things that you learn from generation of school to generation of school are going to be changing. Because if they have not changed, then the progress has stagnated. And if the stagnation has taken place, then the vitality that is there has died and is lost to us all. I think we need to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow when we talk about possibilities of the future that have been opened to us by our new capability of travel in space. But they really apply equally well to our study of the other perspective that we get from the history of peoples who've been here before us. And if we take a sequence, just very briefly, of changes in ideas, we might go back to what we started with on Monday with the revered Bishop of Usher of Ireland, who pronounced after careful study of Genesis that the earth was created precisely at 9 a.m. on October 24th in the year 4004 B.C. And we pointed out that it was really a very short time after that that people like Lyell and Hutton realized that the evidence was very much to the contrary, that Darwin added to this very substantially, but that as late as the 1920s, Scopes was put on trial for daring to teach that evolution might be a realistic possibility. Well, a similar sort of change has come just within the scientific thinking in terms of antiquity of man in the new world. Up until the 1930s, Aleš Hrdlicka, the greatest physical anthropologist of the new world at that particular time, was insisting that there was no real evidence for man in the new world more than perhaps 6,000 years ago. And that at the very outside, perhaps not more than 2,000 to 4,000 years ago. Hrdlicka's students took this far too seriously, far more than he himself would have wanted to have been taken, and said that early man could not have been in the New World more than 4,000 years ago. These ideas were blown apart by the discovery in the 1930s of the Folsom and Clovis cultural materials, in which associated directly with the bones of mammoths, in fact, embedded within them, within the position of the carcass, were the projectile points and the scrapers left by the men that we now call Clovis. And at a time span somewhat later, the projectile points left by Folsom man in association with the bones of the great extinct Ice Age bison. In the Pacific Northwest, that still left no demonstrable evidence, no unchallengeable evidence for really early man prior to a period of about 4,000 years. Until 1948, when a geology professor from Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, who was interested in paleontology, was wandering down a coulee over near a little town named Warden, and in the banks of Lynn Coulee he found a few bones sticking out. And one of his former students, Dick Doherty, who is now professor of anthropology at Washington State University in Pullman, was interested in archaeology, and he called Dick over, and they went and looked at the site, and Dick scraped down the sidewall and heard the characteristic ring of chipping detritus on the trowel, and poked around and found, in fact, there was some chipping debris there.
What is that?
The ring?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just a mechanical thing. You're scraping through sand and you hit something made of stone. It has a different sound. It's like striking a bell with something coarse. It tells you that there's something other there than simply the matrix, which might be a rock fragment or it might be a chip, and in this case it was a chip. Well, this led to additional testing, and ultimately in 1951 and 1952 into excavation of the Lynn Coulee site, which ultimately served Dick as his doctorate material for his doctoral dissertation. The things that were found at Lynn Coulee were really exciting. First of all, there were implements that were unlike the implements known from more recent times in Washington at that period, and resembled some very early but as yet undated materials that had been found in Oregon and Northern California and Nevada, especially including some peculiar crescentic shaped tools for which we still don't really know the use. There were also some projectile points which were leaf-shaped except they contracted at the base for the same sort of hafting of which you saw an example yesterday in the movie. And with them were the bones of a very large bison, perhaps large enough to be the extinct Ice Age form. But more important than that, bits of egg from geese, bones, some of them embellished for some artistic purpose, from beaver, including the teeth, which were the decorated portions, muskrat, elk, all species that require a substantial supply of water on a year-round basis. Prior to the Columbia Basin Irrigation Project, Warden was almost in the middle of that bullseye pattern that has developed now in precipitation as a result of the raising of the Cascade Arch and the rain shadow. There's less than 8 inches annual precipitation there. Lynn Coulee in 1948 was a bare, dry stream path with no discharge down it except at occasional periods of unusual rainstorms or snow and sudden meltwater. The sand dunes were advancing across it, and the characteristic vegetation was that of the entire interior plateau of Washington, sagebrush and bunchgrass. And yet, here were muskrat and beaver, which were dependent upon year-round precipitation and flowing water on a continual basis. And the sediments themselves were sediments produced by Lynn Coulee at a time when it carried water on a year-round basis, and in the springtime was spilling out over its banks and depositing silt and sand to produce what we call overbank sediments, the sort of things that build up a floodplain. And it was on this floodplain that people were encamped. And then, all of a sudden, with those excavations, it became clear that early man had been in Washington at a time far in advance of what we had thought previously, or for which there had been evidence previously, that he had been there at a time when the climate was cooler and moister than it is now, and at a time when the fauna and the vegetation were different than they are now. Just about at that time, Willard Libby discovered the technique for radiocarbon dating, measurement of the radioactive decay of radiocarbon, which is ingested by all living organisms and built into the framework of their organism so long as they live, and then gradually after their death begins to decay and reduce its proportion relative to normal carbon. One of the first dates run by Willard Libby and his carbon 14 day method consisted of burned bone material from Lynn Cooley, and the date was 8,700 years before present. Early man was in the New World a long time ago, even in the Pacific Northwest. Still was not as early as Folsom or Clovis, where Clovis, for example, as you gathered yesterday, would go back on the order of perhaps 13,000 years, and we have many radiocarbon dates for that now. But the search goes on, and by 1962, there was an impetus that had not been present previously for archaeological research, and this was the construction of dams and reservoirs, which already had begun along the Snake and Columbia Rivers. By 1948, as a result of legislation that had been passed by, authored by Warren Magnuson and passed by Congress, government agencies were empowered to spend money to salvage antiquities to preserve them in areas where they were about to be destroyed by government construction projects. And so in the late 50s, there was a survey of an area that was to be covered by Lower Mine Metal Reservoir at some unspecified time in the future. In 1962, construction of the dam was authorized, and therefore with it a little bit of money to begin excavation. And out of the 70-some sites that were selected to be excavated, there was one that looked particularly interesting. It was the village of the Palouse Indians, a band of the Nez Perce who had encamped at the mouth of the Palouse River, whose presence had been noticed by Lewis and Clark when they passed there in 1807. And both Dick and I thought that this would be an obvious place to begin excavation. Unfortunately, in construction of the railroad at the turn of the century, the vegetation in the area had been so disturbed that the sand dunes had been re-released, and the sand dunes blowing out all the material had taken the cultural record that had built up over thousands of years and collapsed it to a single surface, so that materials that might be 6,000 or 8,000 years old were inseparable from things that had been left there during historic time. And so in order to try to find that sequence, we decided to try excavation in one of several rock shelters, others of which Dick had excavated previously, and picked one on a ranch owned by the Marmis family because it was close enough to the Palouse River to have had water available, but far enough from the river, high enough above the river, that the river at flood stage would not have removed materials from the interior. And therefore, we hoped that at least we would get a good geological record, and that perhaps, even though there might not be much cultural material, there might be interspersed with there geological material, enough diagnostic artifacts that we could put in sequence the sites that we had excavated as single component or single occupation sites from various areas elsewhere within the reservoir. Well, within the first few weeks, a test was made, and Helen and I were in the process of moving from one house to another when a neighbor came over and said that there was a long-distance call for me. And it was Dick on the phone saying that in their test pit in the rock shelter, they had encountered white material that appeared to be volcanic ash, probably the volcanic ash from the catastrophic eruption of Mount Mazama in Oregon, which produced the crater lake about 6,700 years ago. And that under this material, if it was ash, was human skeletal material. And if this was the case, this would be by far the earliest human skeletal material that had yet been found in the Pacific Northwest, almost double the age of anything else that we knew of. And Dick wondered whether I'd be interested in coming down, and I allowed as how I would be, and the boxes that were stacked in the dining room and living room remained unopened for weeks while Helen and I went to Marmon's Rock Shelter. And the bones, in fact, were the bones of an individual who had died on the rock shelter floor, perhaps due to disease, perhaps due to illness, but one who apparently had died there alone because his bones had not been buried at the time of the eruption. They were partly disarticulated. Rodents had carried portions of the skeleton to various parts of the shelter, and the ash had sifted down over the surface and preserved him. Well, this was about the time that we realized that Palouse Village was not the place to dig, and work was shifted as much as possible within a confined space to excavate at Marmon's Rock Shelter. By the end of that season, it was clear that man had occupied Marmon's Rock Shelter for at least 8,000 years, and that in doing so, he had left a sequence not only of his tools, but also of the bones of the animals that he had killed and eaten there, also of some of the members of his group who had died and who had been buried there through that span of 8,000 years. And within a context of climatic change recorded by the changing type of sedimentation within the rock shelter. Rock shelters, because they are unlike deep solution caverns, unprotected from the elements, are subjected to freeze-thaw cycles, particularly during the wintertime, due to temperature change from morning to night. And therefore, one of the prime types of deposit in a rock shelter will be the spalled rock that has been pried off the rock shelter ceiling by the frost attack. And unless you have a small boy armed with a long stick to wander around for 8,000 years prying rocks off the ceiling, there's really no other reason for them to come down except for climatic conditions. We began to realize that the rate of rock fall had changed through time. That there early in the sequence of deposits was a great deal more rockfall than there had been during a subsequent period, and then there had been a shift to an intermediate period, and that the people therefore had had to live through and adapt to the climatic changes represented here. And those early changes with great deal of rockfall obviously indicated conditions cooler and moister now, for the amount of rockfall was greater at that time than it is at the present. Well, this was intriguing. Since the cultural material still continued, we decided to come back the next year. And by the end of the next year, the amount of material that had been collected was increased even further, and the record was that much more complete. Under salvage situations, a person simply can't afford to spend additional time at one site when there are 75 or 120 or 150 other sites to be excavated. And funds are limited, and so the work moved on to other sites, or was supposed to. Except that the last day of excavation, in cleaning up the base of the pit the particular student had been working in, human bones turned up at a level of 8,000 years ago. And so we came back one third season to try to wrap things up. It was impossible to excavate it during that day. We very quietly covered things up, backfilled the pit, and had to wait until the next year. Well, by the time the excavations were done the next year, it was clear that man had been in the rock shelter for something on the order of 10,000 years. But at those lowest levels, there was very, very little indication of what type of tools he had used. In fact, very little indication of his activities there, except for a mound of shells that obviously had been collected from the river and carried up and left in the cave. The radiocarbon dates on those shells ran between 10 and 11,000 years before present.
What kind of shell?
River mussels. Clams about this large. Of a type which is not common in the river today, incidentally, although they still live in the area. Well, with that, it was obvious that no further work could be done, so the excavations moved on to other places, and I came back the next year with Roland Marmus, who donated his time and his little Alice Chalmers bulldozer, to try to take advantage of an unusual situation in which we had a rock shelter within which we had obvious climatic fluctuations evidenced by the basis of the sediments and also now by the faunal remains within them that could be connected with the floodplain of the river so that we could see whether the rockfall was a result simply of temperature change due to cooler conditions or whether the river would show moisture change due to difference in the size of its channel, due to difference in amount of precipitation and runoff. And here was a first place that anyone had had an opportunity to actually connect the two. And so Squirt took his bulldozer and began cutting a trench from the center of the rock shelter down to the floodplain in front. And it was July, and it was about 110. And every time he would make a cut, I'd follow the cut, looking to see if anything was turning up. And when the cut had gotten down to a depth of about 12 or 14 feet, suddenly after one pass of the bulldozer, there were bits of bone all over the base of the trench. And I decided that maybe that was a good place to stop bulldozing for the day, and Squirt thought it was too because the temperature was getting on towards 120. So I spent the rest of the afternoon crawling around on my hands and the knees in the bottom of the trench picking up the pieces. But it wasn't until Thanksgiving that we could come back again and look to see if those materials really were in place. It was entirely possible. There was cultural material uphill inside the shelter. He had picked some stuff up with a blade and smeared it down along the bottom of the trench, and it wasn't really in place at all. But if it was in place, then it had come from sediments that underlay the 10 to 11,000-year-old sediments up in the rock shelter. And the zoologist in the lab, Carl Gustafson, looked at the bones and found that there were at least three species of animals present. Some of the bones were charred. There was also mussel shell. And this is a combination that one wouldn't ordinarily find due to natural purposes. You might find an occasional skeleton of an animal, an occasional stray bone. It might have been scorched by a prairie fire. But the combination of these was especially suspicious. Well, by this time, all the funds were gone. And so for 3 years, we went down on weekends or spare afternoons. And by 1967, still it was impossible to prove that the materials had come from in place, but we had more and more materials. And of these materials, some of the bone fragments that had been put together formed the upper portion of the human skull. And if that meant then there really was human skeletal material, here was an opportunity to see what really early man in the Pacific Northwest looked like. And so on a last-ditch effort in the spring of 1968, we went down with a crew of students as a class, started working weekends. By that time, the Marmus family home had been moved out, and we lived in the root cellar and chipped the ice off the buckets in the morning to make breakfast. And by one Sunday afternoon in April, we found a 1-inch square fragment of bone embedded in sediments that had been not disturbed by the bulldozer. And that 1-inch square fragment of bone fit exactly in the middle of the skull cap that had been produced by the other 50 pieces over the last 3 years. So now all of a sudden we knew that we had early man, in fact the earliest well-documented human skeletal material in the New World, and we had just a matter of months to find out about him before the reservoir was to be filled. So Dick and I flew to Washington, and in Warren Magnuson's office in the old Senate office building, announced the discovery, and Senator Magnuson followed the announcement with assurance that funds would be made available for the last ditch effort to find out about this before the reservoir was flooded, which on his part was a particularly appropriate gesture in view of the fact that it was possible to do this at all was a result of legislation that he had authored. Well, that summer, by June, we had a crew of 35 people, including graduate students and undergraduates, with a minimum of 5 years of excavation experience, four archaeologists, a geologist, a zoologist, consultants from botany and soils and ecology and palynology, all working on the site. By the end of the summer, we had uncovered the skull cap of a second individual, the portions, including a few teeth, of a 7 or 8 year old child, projectile points that had been made, which looked like the ones at Lynn Cooley, 4 bone needles, about the size of one that you'd buy in the store today, with the tiny eye that had been cut after the needle had been fashioned. We knew this because we found one that somebody had broken while he was trying to cut the eye, and he snapped the shaft and threw it away. It was kind of satisfying to know that 10,000 years ago people were goofing things up too. We ran out of money. Magnuson, again on our behalf, arranged funds to continue through the fall. During this period of time, there had been growing public sentiment to preserve the site, and a feasibility study was done by the Corps of Engineers to see whether a levee might be constructed. It was announced from the Corps office that this would be feasible. Magnuson authored legislation through the Senate, which would provide the funds for them to do so. The day before Congress adjourned, I received a call from Carl Downing, Magnuson's press secretary, saying that the levee had been authorized, and I flew down to the site in a Piper Cub, which we were using for transportation, and landed on the floodplain and told the crew the news, went home, dismissed my classes, broke out a bottle of champagne, and sat around and celebrated. And in the morning when I went to the office, the telephone was ringing while I opened the door, and it was Carl. And the bill had been killed in the Senate House Conference Committee. And so I went back down to the site. It was afternoon. It was getting dark, and it was raining, and the kids were inside the cook tent, which was leaking, and they were huddled around the stove. And I had to tell them that the deal was off, that that was it. And so Pete Fountain and I flew back through the thunderstorm. We finally followed the headlights of the cars from Colfax to Pullman to the airport and landed. And I stopped off at the office to check mail on my way home. The telephone was ringing, and it was Carl again, reading the text of a letter from Senator Magnuson to President Johnson, pointing out that presidential intervention was the only hope of saving the rock shelter at this stage of the game. Ultimately, this was forthcoming. Apocryphally, from the News Corps at the White House, Mr. Johnson picked up the telephone and called General Cassidy and said, "Do it, damn it." In fact, the Corps discovered that it had somehow overlooked the fact that it actually did have authority to construct such a levee. And the levee was constructed. And as those of you who saw the film yesterday, in spite of a tremendous job on the part of Peter Kiewit and Sons, who had the construction contract and the Corps personnel on the site, errors in design resulted in the water coming up inside the levee as fast as they did outside the levee. And so Marmot Rock Shelter is under 30 to 50 feet of water, and we have excavated about a fourth of the potential material there. Well, what do you do? Well, first of all, you don't ever expect to see a situation like that again in one person's lifetime, where you have the geological record of 8,000 years of geological events with the last 10,000 years of tools of the people who lived and died there, the animals they killed and ate, the bodies of those they buried there, interspersed through that long a time span. But Marmaris had given us some ideas. For one thing, although the projectile points at Marmaris looked like those from Lin Kuli, nothing else did. And geologically, Lin Kuli, on the basis of what we had learned, was beginning to look suspiciously older than the 8,700 years that Libby's early radiocarbon date had suggested. In fact, the cultural sequence from 10,000 years ago at Marmaris Rock Shelter on to the present now was well understood. Lin Kuli didn't look anything like that. So either there were people at the same time as Marmaris living up on the plateau making different tools, except for projectile points, or the people at Marmaris were going up there and using different tools for different things, or there were people at Lin Kuli even earlier than at Marmaris. Well, since Dick was there in the 1950s, the Columbia Basin Irrigation Project had been established, and this meant that Lin Kuli now was serving a functional purpose as a wasteway for excess irrigation water, which would flow down into the Kuli, down the Kuli into the potholes reservoir to be recycled for the next portion of the irrigation basin to the south. At the site, this meant that annually the water table fluctuates, rises and lowers, and therefore the bone which had been fossilized is now being leached as a result of this fluctuation in the water table related to irrigation practices. And so through the Bureau of Reclamation, on whose property this site now rests, we decided that if we were going to find the answer to that question, we were going to have to do it now, because 10 years from now those bones will have been destroyed and that opportunity will be gone also. 3 years ago we went back, Ann and Henry Irwin, the archaeologists, did some testing. They found some bison bone, relocated a corner of one of Dick's old trenches. Last year we went back, re-excavated his trenches so we could re-establish control to relate our materials to his material. And this summer went back with a group of about 25 people and continued the excavation. Last summer we found that, contrary to what Dick had thought back in the 50s, man had been at Lin Kuli not during one short span, but during at least 5 or 6 periods of time. And that among the animals that he killed was the extinct giant bison. We found the skull of a bison calf, 9 months old, the size of a full-grown cow. Also found the bones of elk and antelope, muskrat, again, skunk, the eggs of geese, indicating that the people had been utilizing the site during the springtime. And this summer, more of the same, with an additional bonus, and that is, this past year we've had the driest year in the past 20 to 30 years. And the water table is now 1 meter or 3 feet lower than it was last year. Where we had to cut off last year at the water table, it was now possible to dig down another 3 feet. About 4 weeks ago, Henry was scraping in the trench wall and he found some light-colored material just under some of the cultural material, almost 3 feet below where we'd been working last year. And when we got in there, got a little bit of it out and dried it, looked at it under magnification, it turned out to be volcanic ash. Well, at Marmaris we had found volcanic ash from the eruption of Glacier Peak just over the pass here, 12 to 13,000 years ago, just under the cultural material. And here we were again with it just under the cultural material. And so I spent about 8 hours the next day in a little slip trench in mud up to my knees collecting this for analysis, which is now going on in Denver and in Pullman. And a few days later, in the next slip trench where another student was working, was bison bone and fragments of cultural chipping debris at vertically a lower position than the Glacier Peak Gash. The question was, is it straightest sloping, or were they horizontal? If they were horizontal, the material was under Glacier Peak Gash. And so my son spent the last 2 weeks of the season connecting a trench. Just before coming up here, the job was completed, and the thin lens of ash extends right over the cultural material. The identification of the ash is still not certain. There's one other possibility of a slightly younger eruption that it could be. But if that cultural material now, as we know, is under the ash, and if that ash turns out to be from the eruption of Glacier Peak, as appears probable, then we have early man in eastern Washington at 13,000 years ago. Now, as we know, is under the ash, and if that ash turns out to be from the eruption of Glacier Peak, as appears probable, then we have early man in eastern Washington at 13,000 years ago. That is as early as any fully acceptable site anywhere in the New World. Well, I think you can take it from there. The question keeps on continuing. If he was there then, what was he doing? We've seen now only an area half the size of this hearth, and yet we have from it tools, the bones of bison, a rock on which the bison bone was crushed to extract the marrow, the pieces of the bone that was split that fit back together again. Well, we'd like to be back next year.
Can you date the bone?
It may be possible to now. Bone is not a very reliable dating material because it's necessary to deal either with the bone carbonate, which can exchange easily chemically, or with a protein called collagen, which deteriorates rather rapidly. And so there's some question as to whether there'll be enough collagen left in there to do the job. Well, this gets us pretty much to the position in which we are right now. And I guess the question is why is it all important? What does it all mean outside of the fact that it's curious? Well, one thing that it means is that we know now that for at least 13,000 years in the New World, and we would guess at least 35,000 years in the New World, that man has had to live with his environment, and the things that he has been able to do have been limited by that environment, just as the opportunities for what he can do are offered by that environment. And as we sit here now with that environment in jeopardy, as I said once previously this week, perhaps it behooves us to stop to think about the fact that if we make that environment uninhabitable, it is going to be a great deal more difficult for us to pick up our dams and our reservoirs and our irrigation projects and our factories and our railroads and our cities and move someplace else than it was for early man at Marmot's Rock Shelter, for early man at Lynn Cooley, for our immediate predecessors here 500 years ago to move to a more favorable location. We have the capacity to move now, and we know that looking back on Earth, our environment is the unique one, and that if we are going to go elsewhere, that we are going to have to develop the capability of carrying our own environment with us. And that is a pretty sobering thing, and that's what I'd like to talk about a little bit tomorrow. We'll meet next door in the Village Center, and I'd like to use a film from Apollo 11 to close the series off. So thanks for coming. We'll see you then. It's impossible for me to say what I want to say and to show you what I want to show you and be done at 12.
Pardon? I intend to run over. And if you need to leave to catch the first lunch and get ready for catching a bus, please feel free to do so. If you'd like to stay, I have to stay to wrap things up anyway. Sun to plant, plant to beast, never change nature's round, perfect sound. Harmony of energy constantly yet the same, nature's game, sunrise to green plants, to creatures that fly, that run, transfer of energy, life and death are one. And this morning we come to the end of our discussion of that tenuous and tenacious web of life of which we are a part. And we do so finding ourselves at the pinnacle of the pyramid of energy, which is built on that web of life. And we're perched precariously here now with the capability of so disrupting and destroying the base of that pyramid that one by one its parameters are being stretched to their elastic limits. And should they be stretched to the point that one by one they snap, most assuredly that endless chain would continue. And most assuredly it would continue without our life continuing as we know it now, and quite possibly, perhaps quite probably, without us ourselves. Ironically, the social and environmental problems that are brought to focus now are brought to focus just at the time that we have reached the pinnacle of our technological success, and for the first time man has set foot on another planet. It's been only a few years since John Kennedy committed us, and I say us purposefully, to place a man on the moon within a decade. And it has been just 4 years and 1 month since Neil Armstrong and Buzz Armstrong did so. When I said that I said we purposefully, it was because I meant us, those of us in the United States who did so. In the history of the world, there have been only two projects attempted that have been of the immensity and the complexity of the Apollo program. One, of course, was Apollo. The other one was the Manhattan Project, which produced the atomic bomb during World War II. Both of these are products of our society, of our technology, of our determination, of our singleness of purpose, and our commitment to a particular goal. And now, after having done so, we hear comments to the fact that having put a man on the moon, we should turn our attention to our problems on Earth. And that in turning our attention to our problems of Earth, we should ignore those of outer space and get on with the business at hand, cut off our appropriations for the continued exploration of outer space, and immediately put our house in order. I'm appalled by comments like that. I find them hopelessly naive. Let me give you some examples. First of all, I think it's evident that if we're to solve our social and environmental problems, which are infinitely more complex than either Manhattan or Apollo, we are going to need at our disposal all the resources that we can possibly command, including our newly found ability to explore and to learn from the opportunities of outer space. And a great part of our fallacy in thinking that by turning from outer space to problems of the cities or problems of the environment on a monetary basis is our concept that if something needs to be done, we simply pour enough money into it and it'll go away. If this was correct, let me put the Apollo program in monetary perspective for you. In the history of our country, our gross national product reached $1 trillion. The entire space program, not just Apollo, but the entire aerospace program, including civilian and military expenditures, account for about 1% of that $1 trillion. If we take our national budget, which I did a year ago for 1969, which was past the peak year of expenditures for exploration of space, and which was quite an education, attempting to thread my way through the pages and unravel what belonged where. I was surprised to find that not only did total expenditures for aerospace comprise only approximately 1/30th of the expenditures for the military budget, but they comprised only 1/20th of the budget for welfare and education and health. I put the words in those orders because I'm not talking simply about HEW, I'm talking about all the related programs. To suppose then that we can suddenly take 1/20th of the amount we already are spending on problems that we are not yet capable of defining and solve those problems is the reason that I find the answer of cutting off our exploration into outer space to solve those problems hopelessly simplistic and hopelessly naive. Neil Armstrong has pointed out that to expect man to stop now in his exploration of outer space would be as ridiculous as it would have been to expect the Europeans to have stopped at the western edge of Maryland and Virginia when they first settled the New World. And when I said that we need all the capabilities at our command, I'd like to remind you that at the moment that we are sitting here, the first of the Earth's satellites is circling us, monitoring volcanic activity around the globe, monitoring disease in our crops, moisture levels in our forest, moisture level in our soils, snowpack, weather, the weather forecasting that is possible now through the Tyro satellites permits forecasting that was unthinkable when I was in high school, scarcely dreamt of when I was in college, and has been routine now for at least 5 or 6 years. And I'd remind you of the hurricane which attacked the Florida coast not long ago, which resulted in the loss of approximately 28 lives, because as a result of tracking by satellite of that hurricane, sufficient advance warning was possible to evacuate the people who lived along the Florida coast. Prior to that time, estimates would have put the loss of life on the order of 200,000. At about the same time, you may recall that a similar hurricane struck the southern coast of India, and approximately 1 million people died. In this case, not because we did not have the capability of predicting the hurricane, because it was predicted also, but because we lacked the technology to move the people, or even to tell them that they should leave. As I say, we need all the resources that we have at our command. All of this leads me to a conclusion which I guess can best be stated rather bluntly. We've failed to achieve similar success in solving our social problems and our environmental problems, quite simply because we really don't care. Our success with Manhattan and Apollo, which were dependent upon a singleness of purpose, a cooperation and communication between enormous numbers of individuals with what previously would have been thought to be hopelessly divergent viewpoints and capabilities and attitudes showed what could be done if we really wanted to do it. And therefore, I see only one conclusion. Until we really do want to solve these problems, we're not very likely to. Which puts us in a very awkward position. If you think back to July of 1969, because I was at the Manned Spacecraft Center at that time, it was a very magic time, not only for those of us in the United States, but for people all over the world. One of the striking things about that first attempt to put a man on the moon was perhaps the one major feature about such an attempt that no fiction writer predicted ahead of time. If you think back to Jules Verne, he considered, as NASA did some years later, and afterwards, to just reflect on that for a minute or two, and then we'll go on to dinner.
Over 3 billion years ago, life first appeared in the scene of an even earth.
In this country, we've forgotten the magic that was part of July in 1969. We've become blasé about it, and we've gone on to other things. And I find it more and more striking that we're almost alone in this. This is one of our few endeavors on a national basis of which almost the entire world approves. And all of us who were involved with it and have had the opportunity to travel abroad have been met, I think, with the same response, which is one of excitement and admiration and curiosity and absolute incredulity that the American public could so quickly have forgotten what it was that it just accomplished. By chance, after the first three Apollo missions, I went directly from the Lunar Receiving Laboratory to work at an archaeological site in a cave in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada in Spain near Granada, near a little mountain village in those foothills. And in those three seasons, I never met anyone who had not watched the entire EVA of each of those missions on televisions, huddled together around the family TV, if there was one, more likely huddled together in the little bar that served that street in town. And on Apollo 17, while we watched fragmentary scraps cast to us at the discretion of ABC and NBC, CBS, a million people in the Belgian Congo watched the EVAs of the entire mission in their entirety. I had a long discussion about this one January with Art Bloom from the New York Times, as a science writer, mentioned the fact that these people in the village, whom we would consider underprivileged by any of our standards in this country, undereducated by any of our standards in this country, seemed much more perceptive about the significance of what we had done than our own population. Because they remember a person named Columbus who set out for a ridiculous purpose. And although the glory that came to Spain as a result of the financial returns from that exploit has long since vanished, it's still part of their heritage. And they still remember what it meant. And they still remember what it accomplished. And Art made the comment, well, that's easy to say. It's not their tax dollar that's supporting the program. What was equally easy for them to say, and which had no involvement with anyone's tax dollar, was what I think was a very profound observation to come from an illiterate manual wheat farmer in a tiny mountain village, that, well, it is a funny thing, but we understand because you Americans like to do fun things. And you're not really very good at finishing things up. When you've had the fun, you like to go on to something new. And yet, we find ourselves in a position where we cannot go on to something new. Because our lives can never be the same. Our concept of ourselves and of our environment and our world changed immediately and forever with those first superb photos from Apollo 8 of the Earth, finite and blue and beautiful and isolated and tiny in space. And now we have no choice but to recall Archibald MacLeish's comment that we are all riders on the earth together. What this means for us, of course, is that we must all work together and communicate together, and share the common bond of humanity that has been our heritage from the beginning and that must continue to be to our heritage if there will be a future. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to share with you for just a few minutes a little bit of the magic that was Apollo 11. And afterwards, to just reflect on that for a minute or two, and then we'll go on to dinner.
Over 3 billion years ago, life first appeared in the scene of an even distance.